everyone. Welcome to the bonus episode. Hello, Dominic.
Hi, Tom.
Here we are back again.
Yeah, lovely.
And I mean, maybe you'll have listened to all the episodes on Custer's Last Stand that we've put out. We are going to leave answering questions on that until next week, I think, or maybe the week after.
Yeah.
Today, Dominic, we're just going to look at some general questions. We had some absolutely brilliant ones, so we just want to make sure that we don't lose them.
Yes.
So here is one for you, kicking off. It's from BHL. Do you think that's, is it Bernard-Henri Lévy?
Yeah, undoubtedly.
Do you think he's listening?
Yeah, undoubtedly.
With his Peter Frankopan-esque shirt.
Yes.
Open at the navel. And he has asked, which had the more enthusiastic support in Britain while it happened? World War One or World War Two? Actually, he must sound American, BHL.
Does he?
So I'm going to reframe that.
Okay.
Which had more enthusiastic support in Britain whilst it happened? The First World War or the Second World War?
Okay, well done, Tom. The First World War. Slightly counterintuitively. Certainly when they broke out, I would say the First World War, there was greater enthusiasm. And that's not to say that everybody was delighted by any means. But I don't think there was any enthusiasm for the Second World War.
No.
Because people knew what world wars were like. They thought it would be terrible. They were determined in the Second World War in 1939. I think the fact that Hitler had broken his promises so many times, the fact that he had been given that chance at Munich was really important, actually, to Britain going into the war.
United.
United and determined. I think had Britain gone into the war, even in 1938, there would have been a greater sense of, you know, do we have to do this?
But do you think over the course of the two wars, that switches?
Yes, possibly.
I mean, by 1918, isn't there a kind of grinding sense, oh, we've got to get this over and done with? Whereas with the Second World War, by the end, as you know, the death camps start to be found and people think, actually, you know, this has been a good thing.
At the end, but I think one of the things we forget with the Second World War is that for long periods, there was a real sense of, we haven't won a battle for ages.
Yeah.
The war is going nowhere. People are sick of the rationing. They are very ground down. And I think 1942, there is quite considerable discontent with Churchill's war leadership, with the war generally. Because, of course, at that point, Britain is still going backwards, especially in the Far East. I mean, Britain has gone significantly backwards. And before El Alamein, Churchill is absolutely desperate for a victory because basically, yeah, the war has been going on for years and Britain has barely won a single victory. So the sort of hurrah, hurrah, VE Day spirit, this was a noble crusade and we're all delighted that we're fighting it and that we've won it. You don't see much of that, I would say, in the first 2 or 3 years of the war. Mm. The First World War, first of all, at the outset, there's obviously a lot of enthusiasm. You know, there's a lot of the kind of, let's wave our straw hats in the air. You know, it makes a change from watching Burnley versus Blackburn and going to the Oval and all that sort of.
Yeah.
You know, that's sort of the classic 1914 scenes. It's a bank holiday, we're going to war, brilliant. Well, it's going to be a tremendous laugh. There's an element of that.
But there's also a very strong element that there isn't that. I mean, that is overplayed, isn't it? The idea that everyone was brilliant, we can have a war.
But there is some of that, though, and there isn't any of that in 1939.
Yeah.
So let's not dismiss that completely. Absolutely right. There are a lot of people who think the war will be terrible and are in, you know, Margot Asquith is in tears.
Lights are going out over Europe.
The lights are going out, all that. Yes, totally.
Yeah.
But there is still some enthusiasm. I mean, there are people, you know, all across Europe waving hats and leaning out of trains and shouting, see you in Berlin or whatever, all of that kind of stuff.
Or Paris.
Or Paris. Exactly. The other thing I think in the First World War that we often miss is people often say, well, why didn't the First World War end earlier? Why didn't they just agree? It's been a terrible mistake. It's a horrible stalemate. And the reason is lots of people really want to win it. And lots of the public really, really want to win it. They believe the propaganda on both sides. They think it's a noble crusade. They don't want the sacrifice to have been for nothing. There is a real spirit of, come on, let's do this. I think in the Second World War, there's a generally much greater sense of weariness, particularly in Britain. It's one reason, actually, where some historians like Max Hastings say Britain doesn't fight the Second World War very well. It's that Britain is tired of war already.
But my brother would say Britain fights it very well.
Yeah.
David Edgerton, this is a debate in which I think the balance of opinion has swung against the kind of Max Hastings.
I think it depends what level you're looking at. So there are ways in which Britain is underrated in the Second World War because people have been misled by the kind of ridiculous trousers and sort of weak-chinned, mustachioed men kind of in huge shorts.
Britain's very, very good at killing people in the Second World War.
Yeah, and Britain is technologically and industrially extremely successful.
Lethal.
Yeah, it's ruthless, and it mobilizes its economy, its industry, you know, far better than I think it's usually given credit for. And of course, Britain is pioneering in kind of radar and all these kinds of things.
Bouncing bombs.
But at the same time, I think there is a general sense that on the ground, British commanders are reluctant to risk the lives of their men. Maybe they value human life too highly. Certainly compared with them. Think about Soviet commanders. Oh my God. You know, they'll happily throw thousands of men into the kind of charnel house.
But I mean, the British strategy is the same that it was in the Napoleonic Wars.
Yeah.
Which is essentially...
let someone else do the fighting on land.
Let someone else do the fighting, pay for it.
Yeah.
And then kind of, you know, step in and mop up the mess.
Yes. I think it's easier to do in the Napoleonic Wars, frankly, than in the Second World War.
It is. But Britain and the United States, well, they win. But also relative to the casualties that they had in the First World War, I mean, they don't lose that many people.
No, you're right. You're absolutely right. Anyway, I think we'll come back to the First World War because we're going to do a little series on it, or indeed quite a big series in the summer because it'll be the 110th anniversary and because I think it's actually far, far more interesting than it's given credit for because people just think it's all very boring, stuck in the trenches. But I think, as we will find out, Tom, when we go to Sarajevo.
Yeah, we're going to Sarajevo, aren't we?
Yeah.
We're literally going to the place where the wrong turning was made.
Yes.
Not that way, you fool.
Yeah. Are you going to do that?
Yes, I am.
I mean, I think it would be quite tasteless to do it there. But if you, maybe you should wear that suit that you're wearing now, because Tom, people can't see this, but you're wearing a sort of 1914 era suit by the look of it, a sort of brown tweed.
I think it's maybe 1930, perhaps.
You reckon? More Bertie Wooster than...
Slight hint of that, I think. Well, no, I think John Buchan.
Is that what you're hoping?
It's the kind of suit that one would wear while being chased by a German agent across heather.
To me, that's the kind of suit that a man is wearing while he's called into the drawing room by Poirot to be...
Maybe Poirot's sidekick.
Oh, you think you're Captain Hastings? You've dressed as Captain Hastings.
Great Scott. Great Scott, Poirot.
Yeah. Always failing to get the point.
Yeah. You have a hint of Poirot.
I have a hint of Poirot.
Yeah, if we were cast as Poirot and Hastings. I don't think there's any question who would be Poirot and who would be Hastings.
I think I'd be a tremendous Poirot. I think you'd be Inspector Japp. Yeah. Right. Let's do some other questions. Let's do some questions from Tabby's second list. Oh, here's one for you. We did allude to this in our live stream. Do you count the Seven Years' War or the Napoleonic Wars as world wars? And your answer to that in the live stream was you counted the Seven Years' War, but not the Napoleonic Wars?
7 Years' War much more so than the Napoleonic Wars.
Because it takes place on a broader canvas.
Yeah. I think a world war has to take place in a wide array of continents.
But the difference is that, interestingly, the Napoleonic Wars is much more of a total war.
Sure, in Europe.
And I think there's a real sense in Britain. So viewing it from a purely parochial British perspective, which sometimes I like to do.
Sometimes.
I think there's a real sense in the Napoleonic Wars that under William Pitt, for example, Britain is mobilising itself in a way that it has never done before.
I completely agree, but a total war isn't the same as a world war.
I think that's fair.
Iran and Iraq fought total wars against each other, but that wasn't a world war.
Yeah, that's fair.
Whereas the 7 Years' War, they're fighting in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Fighting in Canada, in America. It spreads all the way deep into the heartlands of America. So all the kind of the indigenous tribes are being brought into it as well.
Yeah.
It's being fought in India. It's being fought in the East Indies.
Yeah.
I think that counts definitely as a 7 Years' War.
Tom, you are talking yourself into a series.
I'd love to do the 7 Years' War. I'd really love to do the 7 Years. We did the one with Dan, didn't we? Dan Snow.
We did. But he shamed himself in that by patronising us.
Yes, he did.
And he made a terrible mistake. That'll go down as one of the great examples of hubris, won't it? Because he thought we were the new kids on the block. And he made a joke about us having two listeners.
I'm not going to comment on that. It was very kind of him to come on.
Yeah.
But I think a bit like the French Revolution, which we did in 50 minutes.
Yeah.
I think it is a subject. Well, do you know, I'm sure we've talked about this before. I do think the 7 Years' War is the globally significant subject that is least covered by popular history, public history.
Mm.
There's no popular book on it. As far as I know, never been a kind of television series about it. I suppose The Last of the Mohicans is the only Hollywood film I can think that covers it. And yet it's so important.
And yet, Tom, the great thing about it, of course, is that it's so important for Canada.
It is.
And we have given our Canadian listeners so little in the last 500 episodes, apart from beavers. which occasionally Canadians will surface on social media and they will say, I love The Rest Is History. And they did one episode on Canada. And do you know what they did it on? They did it on beavers.
But they say it in a very, you know, a charming, polite Canadian way.
You don't think they say it in an exasperated, frustrated, offended way?
Maybe a hint of exasperation. But yeah, you know, I mean, the Canadians are always very polite.
They are. Yeah.
Should we make a promise on the record that we will do Canada in the Seven Years' War?
Before the decade is out, we'll have done. Because I want to do, I love General Wolfe and the Plains of Abraham and the Battle of Quebec and all that.
So on the topic of General Wolfe, we do have a confession to make to our Jacobite listeners.
Oh, Tom, this is your confession now.
No, it's yours, Dominic, because you were in charge of structuring General Custer.
Yeah.
And inevitably, what was originally going to be a four-part series has expanded.
Yes, it has.
And Bonnie Prince Charlie is going to be postponed. And I mentioned that in association with Wolfe, because of course, Wolfe fought at Culloden. So we are going to do it. I've done lots of reading on it. We're definitely going to do it at some point.
Yeah.
But it's just not going to be quite as soon as we'd originally hoped it would be.
We've let ourselves down, Tom. We've let the podcast down. We've let the listeners down. And we've let the Jacobites down.
And we've let the king over the water down.
Yeah.
So apologies for that. He will be coming.
An important apology. So we'll do the Jacobites. Yeah. And then at some point after that, we'll do the Seven Years' War.
Yes.
Okay, very good. Okay. Iskithen, what's the most somebody has ever lost for lust?
I suppose the paradigmatic mythological answer to that would be Paris, who, of course, is basically given Helen of Sparta, who becomes Helen of Troy by Aphrodite, because Paris has given her first prize in a beauty contest. And the result of that is that Paris will end up dead. All his family will end up dead. His city will end up obliterated. And, you know, that's quite a lot to lose. Historically, though, I mean, I suppose a Catholic would say Henry VIII.
No, but he didn't lose, did he? He didn't lose anything.
A Catholic would say he lost his soul.
Yeah, but that, they would say that of anybody who...
True.
I mean, I think Henry VIII doesn't lose anything because of his lust. He dies peacefully in his bed.
Well, he gains a lot of loot from monasteries, I suppose.
Yeah.
In the long run. So everyone's a winner, apart from Anne Boleyn.
It's a good question. I'm trying to think of other...
It is a good question. Maybe we should have a think about that and come back to it next week.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm sure there are some really obvious answers to that.
Alia Aenor, what is the difference between an empire and a civilization? That's a good question. And I would say, ultimately, not that much difference. Tom, do you think there's a difference between a civilization and an empire?
I do. I think I would answer that by saying that a civilization is an enduring empire.
Okay. But we were talking the Maya civilization, but the Maya didn't really have an empire.
So China or Rome are examples of empires that become civilizations.
Yes.
That in a sense, people who've been conquered by them. So the Romans conquer Greece, they conquer Asia Minor. People there feel that they have been conquered. They despise the Romans as barbarians. But over the course of the millennia that follow, they come to see themselves as being Roman. And when Constantinople falls, the people who are defending Constantinople call themselves Romaioi. They call themselves Romans. And I guess the example of the empire that has most successfully transformed itself into a civilization would be the Arab Empire.
Interesting. Yeah.
So Islam is a civilization that is an empire that has mutated into a civilization, or it developed into a civilization.
It's interesting. You think empire comes first, whereas I would see it the other way around. I would say...
Not always.
I would say a civilization, our assumption of a civilization is a sophisticated culture, a surplus of wealth, state structure, army of some kind, all of these kinds of things, plus some kind of governing ideology or some religious homogeneity or something that binds you together. I would say that you become expansionist almost by definition.
But I think everyone is expansionist.
Yeah. It's why one of the reasons why I think all the conversations sometimes people have about empires, or empires are terrible things, very sad. I think that's like saying that going to the toilet is very regrettable. I think it's an inevitable part of the human condition that societies, that states will try to exert influence beyond their borders and will try to settle, control, establish troops in trading posts in other parts of the world. I think that's just an inevitability of human history.
I would say that the most enduring and successful empires have been civilizational.
Yeah.
That they have given the people that they've conquered or absorbed or influenced a reason to identify,
yes,
with the kind of cultural package that they're offering.
Of course. You're mad if you don't do that.
And you know, the biggest determinant on, say, West European civilization, even after the Roman Empire has fallen, is Christianity, which is a legacy of the Roman Empire. And is, you know, its prestige is crucially tied up with memories of Roman power.
Mm-hmm.
With the caliphate, it's much more obvious because the caliphate endures. And even when the caliphate collapses, it doesn't matter because the civilizational imprint of that empire is so strong that people no longer need the empire to identify with the civilization that it brought.
Yeah, Tom, I agree with all that.
Okay, well, there we go.
I think empire and civilization are, to some degree, I think, indistinguishable. And certainly the first empires and the first civilizations, I mean, they're effectively the same, I would argue.
Okay, so here is a question on a topic that lots of people study in schools.
Oh.
And we, I think, have only done 2 episodes on. No, maybe 4. And it's from No Filter History. What do you think is the largest turning point in medicine through the course of history?
Oh, God.
So we did those episodes with Carl Harper, didn't we? We did one on the history of pandemics and disease.
Yeah.
And we did one on the impact of disease on the Roman Empire. I mean, I have no doubt, having read those books,
mm-hmm.
and my memory of recording those episodes, is that germ theory, the discovery of germ theory, is the key breakthrough.
I wondered if you would say that. So it's probably something very banal, isn't it? The single biggest improvement in people's health, I would guess, is something probably like washing your hands or clean water.
Yeah.
And I guess that goes hand in hand with the idea of germs, would you say?
Yeah, definitely.
So that predates antibiotics.
Yes.
And I would say it's therefore much more important because the big takeoff in life expectancy, I think, considerably predates antibiotics.
Yeah, it's in the 19th century and it's the discovery of germ theory that you wash your hands, you have clean water.
Yeah.
You're going to live longer. So I would go for that.
Yeah. So I think cleanliness.
But important to emphasize, neither of us are historians of medicine. So
no.
If there are medically informed people listening to this and you disagree, then do please let us know. A slightly more depressing one might be to say, which I also remember from reading Carl Harper's book, is that the emergence of civilization
made people unhealthy.
Make people incredibly unhealthy because they start living in their own shit.
Yeah, they've been cities and towns. Yeah.
And that something like humans are the only species that choose to live surrounded by their own excrement.
Yes. I thought that was really interesting that people in the country were counterintuitively to me much healthier. And the cities, which have always been magnets, are less healthy. But now I think about it, I've been to cities and it doesn't really surprise me.
Exactly. That's why you never come to London.
Yeah. Okay.
Wanky Doodle.
This is really one for you, Tom. I'll ask it. Wanky Doodle's question. If Hitler had known his legacy would be that he is synonymous with evil. So you've often made the argument, haven't you? You said Hitler has replaced Satan in our kind of demonology.
Yeah.
Do you think he would have done anything differently?
Well, I think it's a question for you because this is about the psychology of Hitler.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not really about metaphysics or theology or anything.
Well, you had this, you did that brilliant episode about why the Nazis thought they were right.
Yeah. Hitler didn't think he was evil. Hitler thought he was right.
No.
And part of Hitler's understanding of the way the world and the universe functions is that a race has to prove itself or it is condemned to oblivion. And I think he feels, doesn't he, by the time he's in the bunker,
mm-hmm.
that the Germans deserve their oblivion.
He does.
That the Nordic race has failed.
Yes, that's what he does think.
They have failed to measure up. They've been weighed and found wanting in the scales of history.
Yeah.
And therefore they deserve their oblivion. And he would, I mean, you know, weird, this is a mad argument.
Yeah. That's what the bonus is for then, Tom, let's be honest.
That's what it's all about. But wherever he is, and let's say he's in hell.
Yeah.
You know, he's kind of pondering his posthumous reputation. I guess he would say it was all a Jewish conspiracy and it reflects, you know.
Yeah, right. In the unlikely scenario that, you know, someone invents a time machine, goes back, brings Hitler to 2024.
Rather than shooting him, says,
right. I'll take you on a tour to see what the world is like in 2024 and look particularly, go to the bookshops and have a look at what people think of you. In the unlikely event of that taking place, I think he would say, as you say, it's a mad conversation. And then likely events of that happening, and then also that they speak German, he would say to them, well, this society is rotten and decadent and absolutely horrendous. And this is worse than my darkest fears.
Yeah.
And, you know, he'd look at modern Germany and he would say, no martial spirit, a racially diverse population, all of these kinds of things. I mean, modern Germany would offend him in loads of ways.
And of course, the readiness of Western countries in the wake of the Second World War, not just Germany, to embrace ways of living that are not just incidentally opposed to fascism. Mm. But that's the whole point. I mean, Western countries since the war have consciously sought to construct themselves as the opposite of fascism.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, in a way, Hitler is the architect of a lot of modernity.
Yeah. Imagine, I mean, if you want to push this already ludicrous scenario further forward, imagine you took him to a primary school to listen to a PSHE lesson,
yes,
or whatever they call them, and said, you know, the emphasis on kindness, on not bullying, on looking after each other.
Yes. Hitler is the godfather of contemporary progressivism.
Well, he is to some degree, isn't he?
I think he is, yeah.
I mean, he's the nightmare from which Europe is still trying to escape, I think.
Yeah.
Okay, very good.
Well, so that was a very sensible discussion.
Yes.
So here's a question from Zetby.
Yeah.
And this is about Liz Truss, the Prime Minister of Britain who lasted for less time than a lettuce.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it has to be said, she has not retreated licking her wounds.
No.
She is out and proud. So there was a very good, did you see the thing in Private Eye comparing her to the captain of the Titanic?
Captain Smith, unbelievably.
Captain Smith, yes.
So harsh.
So it kind of, Liz Truss comparing her to Captain Smith and Captain Smith saying that I was quite right to ram the iceberg.
Well, he was. They should have rammed the iceberg. Then they probably wouldn't have sunk.
Right, you're sounding like Liz Truss now.
Yeah.
So she's out and proud. She's got this book out. She's basically saying that she's right, everyone else is wrong.
Yeah.
And Zetby asks, which other ex-prime ministers have written terrible or hilarious memoirs? And of these, which is the worst and which is the most genuinely insightful? Let's broaden that out to any political leader. So presidents, American presidents, prime ministers, whatever.
So most memoirs, I would say, are pretty boring and are also historically, for a historian's point of view, much less useful than you think because they are not written by the person whose name is on the cover. So they're written by ghostwriters. And if you take, let's say, Ted Heath's autobiography, extremely boring. It took him about 30 years to produce it. He went through numerous researchers and ghostwriters. He was impossible to work with.
Astonished me.
And what came out was just unbelievably bland and unrevealing. Margaret Thatcher's book, which was a huge bestseller.
Did she write that?
She didn't write that. No, she had speechwriters, ghostwriters.
Tony Blair wrote his, I think.
I think he probably did write his.
Quite enjoyed that.
But the idea that by and large that they would write them, I mean, we'll certainly write them unaided.
Obama's was very good.
Obama's, but Obama was already a writer.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the thing. Obama had already written books. Most people haven't.
So here's my suggestion.
Yeah.
General de Gaulle.
Oh, I've never read de Gaulle. Is it good?
I don't know, but I know the opening line.
Yeah. All my life I've had a certain idea of France. Lyndon Johnson's book, The Vantage Point. The Vantage Point. That's terrible. Nixon's is very self-regarding. Gerald Ford's very boring. Reagan, obviously, he didn't write it.
What about Churchill?
Well, Churchill wrote in collaboration. I mean, Churchill was a writer, but he wrote so much. Who's read all 17,000?
Who is it said the thing about his history of the First World War? He's written a history of the First World War, which is all about himself or something.
He's written a book called The World Crisis that is all about himself.
Yeah. Who said that? Lloyd George?
Yeah, I think it was Lloyd George who said that.
Yeah.
I mean, Churchill is probably the best. He's an amusing writer. His book, My Early Life, we recommended that, didn't we, to people after we did our series on young Churchill?
Yeah, that's a great book.
It's a great read. It's a great laugh, that.
I suppose that's not about him being prime minister.
But very bad memoirs. Truss is actually, I think, so Truss received an advance for that memoir, which was...
It's about 40p.
Yeah, it was laughably £1,400 or something. I mean, by the standards of advances for politicians.
But, you know, to give her credit, I mean, she's really, I think it was top of the bestseller list. I mean, she's really pushed it hard.
Yeah, but you'll only get that as a politician for a week or 2 weeks, and then it will fall away and no one will ever...
Yeah, but still, she's earned her advance.
She probably has.
I mean, that's how every writer judges success.
It's an interesting point with Truss. All the discussion about her failure has become wrapped up with the idea that she was too ideological. And then on her side, this sort of weird conspiracy theory that she has about the anti-growth coalition who tried to bring her down. But actually what is missed and what she clearly does not get at all is that crucially, she's just really bad at a lot of elements of politics. She's a very poor speaker. She's a very poor performer in an interview. She is wooden. She has no ability to relate to an audience. She has no sense of political subtlety.
I gather that she said that in her memoirs, that she was talking about having to give the address at the Queen's funeral.
Yes.
And she said, I'm hopeless at this kind of thing.
Yeah.
So well, that I have to do this.
Yeah. It's absolutely bonkers that somebody would say that and be so lacking in the awareness that that's an important skill for a politician.
Yeah.
I mean, how could you possibly go into politics thinking that that's incidental communication, when communication, as great politicians instinctively knew, Churchill, Obama, we've mentioned two of them, Nixon knew it, Augustus knew it, you know, communication is the core of politics. And for her to think that's just an add-on and that actually all that really matters is her own ambition is absolutely bonkers.
Of course, somebody who wrote very successful,
yeah,
that not exactly memoirs, but they have an obviously a very strong autobiographical element, is Julius Caesar.
And Julius Caesar's memoirs are very good, though, aren't they? They're very readable.
Yeah, they are.
I mean, people are forced to translate them all the time.
Yeah. You know, they're being read 2,000 years on.
I can't think of many people whose memoirs have invited the same degree of ridicule.
I mean, I think that there is a trend, isn't there? It's a kind of masochistic way of raising your profile and presumably generating income.
Yeah.
That you make yourself an object of hatred to people who are ideologically opposed to you. And then people kind of rally around you. So there are people who do it on, you know, across the political spectrum.
Mm.
They'll take a particularly contrarian attitude and stake their position very publicly on social media. They'll go on the news channels.
Yeah.
And they will thereby give themselves a profile that I imagine kind of translates into an income and a career.
Yeah, you self-radicalize.
There's a sense in which Liz Truss is doing that.
Oh, she's definitely doing that now.
I can't think of any other prime minister who has quite done that.
She's making, I think, an extremely bad call. The whole thing is designed for American audiences. She is gambling that she will get speaking engagements and media appearances on the US kind of circuit.
Yeah. So institutions called the Atlantic Council for Liberty or something. I mean, I don't know whether that exists.
Yeah.
But she'd be all over that like a rash.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because she's done stuff like she's already come out and said, oh, I think I really want Donald Trump to win the next election. You know, he's the man and all that. And ex-prime ministers just never do this.
No, it's demeaning.
You know, Tony Blair, John Major, Margaret Thatcher, whoever, they never do this.
She's the prime ministerial equivalent of Prince Harry.
Yeah.
She's an emblem of our national humiliation.
Yeah, but there's more to Britain than either of those two terrible people, Tom.
I know, but they're basically pimping themselves out to America.
They are. They completely are.
And it's humiliating for all of us.
I mean, actually, Theo says that's harsh on Harry. You could argue that's kind of harsh on Truss. I mean, they're welcome to each other, actually. Let them just crack on. I'm glad to be rid of them. Right, Tom, do we have time for one more question or do you have to go?
One more very quick. I do have to go quite soon and record my episodes on the history of the Oval, which is a rival podcast.
I'm waiting for you to do Brendan's question. So Brendan emailed us. So a reminder that you can email us questions, by the way. You don't just have to submit them on the Discord. You can email them to us.
So this is from Brendan. Shall I skip the opening line of Brendan's question? I don't think we
No, I think the opening line is the core of the question.
All right. So Brendan says, I'm reading Dominic's Never Had It So Good and thoroughly enjoying it. Dominic's argument that the influence of the Lady Chatterley trial and Look Back in Anger, to take but two examples, has been overstated, is persuasive.
Good.
To quote the great Frank McDonough, there was no summer of love down my road. But does Dominic think that any book, play, or music or musician has had the sort of influence that is attributed to these cultural phenomena? So in other words, this is your shtick.
I wouldn't describe it as a shtick.
Nobody was listening to Sergeant Pepper.
Right.
They were all Sound of Music.
Yeah.
And it's all kind of overblown.
It's a bit overblown. The key word there is influence. So how much do books, plays, albums or musicians or whatever, how much do they influence people and how much do they reflect? And I think as with politics, by and large, I think they can be influential, but often they tend to reflect changes that are already underway. So it would be weird, for example, to claim, it'd be mad to write the history of the 1960s and to say, well, the Beatles were not influential at all. I mean, even I wouldn't make that claim, Tom. Clearly the Beatles, people do copy their interest in kind of Indian mysticism or drugs or whatever. They're probably not as influential. You know, it's not a simplistic kind of one-way process. But I think there's a massive tendency among historians to think that what people like them think really matters, and to overemphasize the opinions of people like themselves. That is to say, a very small subset of the population, overly educated, living in kind of nice, leafy, upper middle class suburbs, and to ignore the fact that most people are actually ignorant of many of the cultural phenomena that they think are so overpoweringly important. I can remember I once had an argument with a colleague at Sheffield when I was teaching at Sheffield. We were talking about Americanization, and I said, more people watch Midsummer Murders than have ever watched The Simpsons in Britain. And he said that couldn't possibly be true, that everybody he knew watched The Simpsons. I think what it was he had shocked that he'd mentioned The Simpsons to some students, and some of them had not known what he was talking about. They hadn't got the reference. And he said, how is that possible? Everybody watches The Simpsons. And I said, I don't think that's true. The Simpsons is on Channel 4 or something. Or BBC 2. It's a smaller channel. I think it only appeals to a small group. I bet it's only a tiny fraction. And he said, no, we had a bet about it. And of course, being a pedant, I went and found out the stats.
Yeah.
You know, 8 million people watch Midsummer Murders every week and 800,000 people watch The Simpsons.
Yeah. Well, it's like nobody's watched The Sopranos.
Right. And I think it's a really, really bad habit among historians to ignore what actually most people are thinking and reading. Now, things are influential on them, but they're not always the things that you think are going to be influential. So look back in anger, the play, the example he gives there. Most people not only never saw that play, of course, they'd probably never even heard of that play and still haven't. So I don't think it's influential.
But Dominic, and we can't have a bonus episode without me saying, but Dominic.
Yeah, we can't. Go on.
I mean, there is something, I think, a slightly different point to be made about Lady Chatterley.
Yeah.
Which is, nobody's saying Lady Chatterley is influential, but it serves as a symbol.
It does.
It serves as a convenient turning point. And, you know, the classic example of that would be the Larkin poem, you know, that sexual intercourse began in 1963 between the end of the Chatterley ban and the Beatles' first LP. And he's making a joke, you know, he's being ironic about that.
Yeah.
But both of those, the Chatterley ban and the Beatles' first LP, have resonance as flags that can be planted in the kind of the history of social and cultural evolution.
Yeah, but that's fixed by historians, or in this case, by a poet.
So the Oscar Wilde trial would be another example, you know, that lots of people never heard of the importance of being earnest, but his downfall serves as a convenient clothes hook from which to hang all kinds of cultural analysis, wouldn't you say?
It undoubtedly does, but I don't think it's influential on the great mass of ordinary people.
Right, it's not influential.
Do you think it's influential, the Oscar Wilde trial? Doesn't change anything.
Maybe it's influential in the way that people understand the past.
Exactly. I think that's the point. I think some things, it's rather like, as if we were having a conversation about a literary canon, I guess, or a musical canon.
Yes.
Let's talk about it in a totally different sphere. Pop music, rock music, the Velvet Underground, let's say. Anybody who's interested in rock music has heard of the Velvet Underground, has heard of Lou Reed, knows the famous album cover with the banana or whatever it is. You know, it's very influential on people who are interested in it and on the genre itself. But actually on the public at large, most people have never heard the album, probably never heard of that band, I would guess. And I think there are almost two parallel conversations going on. And of course, they sort of filter into each other to some degree, don't they? Because what that small group of tastemakers care about does affect the public. It's the public end up copying that, it becomes filtered and diffused, and there are sort of mainstream versions of it and stuff. But I think to lose sight of those teeming millions who are completely oblivious to what you think is so terribly important, I think it's a bad historical tick that academic historians often have.
I would say that probably, say, the most influential work of literature in English,
King James Bible?
Excluding the King James Bible, because I think that's not, you wouldn't categorize it necessarily as a work of literature.
Okay.
Would be Pilgrim's Progress, the Bunyan book.
Yeah.
Which was enormously, enormously influential.
Yeah.
And shaped the way that the Atlantic civilization of Britain and America thought. I mean, now largely not read, but hugely, hugely influential. But Bunyan doesn't feature in English literature courses.
No.
I guess literary scholars would say Milton was more influential than Bunyan, because Milton is influential on the canon, but Bunyan is influential on the way that weavers think.
Yeah, I love that, Tom. Yeah.
and emigrants to the far west in America and, you know, settlers in Australia are thinking.
I agree with you. I totally agree with you. I think you're dead right about that. And I think as well, people are also not always the best judges of what influences them.
Actually, you know, I'd love to do an episode on Bunyan. I think it'd be brilliant.
I remember giving a talk about my book, The Great British Dream Factory, and a kind of youngish, very bright kind of young woman, maybe 22 or something. She said she was a student. You know, she was completely dismissive of what I'd said in the talk. And she said, so for example, you mentioned Dickens and you say that Dickens is really influential and so important today and his legacy endures. She said, that is rubbish. I've never read Dickens and none of my friends ever had. We don't care about Dickens. You know, times have changed. And I said, you're misunderstanding influence. Dickens is in your head, even if you don't know he's in your head. You know, his phrases, his characters, his style is influential on popular culture more broadly. Yeah. There would be no The Wire without Dickens. There would be no Christmas without Dickens. You know, so many of the sort of the dramas, the stories we tell are influenced by Dickens or Shakespeare, and you don't have to have read them to live in their world.
Yeah, and one can make a very similar argument about the Bible, of course.
I think you absolutely could, Tom.
Yeah.
Totally you could. I mean, whether that's changing now is a different matter. And Pilgrim's Progress, by the way, you're absolutely right. There are loads of phrases that people use every day.
The Slough of Despond.
That derive from that book.
Yeah, let's do an episode on that. That would be good. But I think that that is enough.
You've got to go, Tom. You're going to be late.
I've got to go. I'm going to be late.
Anyway, it's a really interesting conversation, this, and we will come back to it at a later point. We are in the middle of Custer. That will be continuing for a couple of weeks for non-club members. And after that, we have Dragons.
D-Day.
Yeah.
Greek Heroes. First World War.
Franz Ferdinand. Yeah.
French Revolution. It's a massive summer.
Yeah.
Of big, high-octane history.
A summer of sport. And that bombshell. Thank you very much. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.